So the title of tonight's talk is Mindfulness in Relationships. So much of our joy in life comes out of our relationships. There's oftentimes such richness and delight in being in the company of others. It's also so that a lot of our suffering comes out of being in contact with others, being in relationship as well. The Buddha spoke about dukkha, or suffering, in a number of different ways. But one of the most fundamental way that he described dukkha, or suffering, has to do with relationship. He said that in being separated from those we want to be with, this is discontent or suffering, and having to be with people that we don't want to be with, this is suffering as well. And it just strikes me that this is really the first thing he said regarding dukkha as a description. It had to do with being with others, in the company of others. Of course, separated from those we want to be with, this means when we lose people to death, or when there is unresolvable conflict, or because of geography, you know, people just aren't around who used to be around. Having to be with people that we don't want to be with, well, oftentimes this means our work environment. You know, we are in a certain work environment and we have to do that kind of work, or we love that kind of work, and yet we wouldn't particularly choose that every being be there doing that particular work with us. And this also, of course, might mean some of our family members as well, under this category of having to be with people that we don't want to be with all the time. And also wanting to be with people who don't want to be with us. You know, at times we experience this as well, sometimes in very blatant and clear and, you know, abrupt and rude ways. And other times, just because people are busy and we have a little bit more time, and so we want to spend time with someone who doesn't want to spend time with us. And so this is some of the suffering that we encounter as well. So this area of relationship, in terms of being mindful in it, is not an easy area. It's quite a difficult area to bring our practice into, because it's an area in which we tend to be most unconscious. We speak in this practice, we start with simply being aware of our bodies and, you know, being aware of the breath, the in-breath and the out-breath. And that's hard enough. And then we see if we can be mindful in the midst of activities, you know, when we're washing the dishes or when we're vacuuming. I always thought it'd be handy if there were a statue of the Buddha vacuuming instead of always just sitting there, you know, kind of reflecting the life that we live. But that's nothing. Vacuuming is nothing when it comes to being awake and aware when we're talking and listening, when we're in contact with another human being. You know, sometimes I see it as clicks, like we start our practice and we're with the body and we come into the body for a moment or two and there's a bit of a click, you know. Maybe we can't sustain it in the way that we want to, but something is solid for us. We're connected, we're aware. And then we continue to practice and we are able to bring our practice a little bit more into our daily life. You know, we don't have maybe 8 hours between when we go to work and then we come out at the other end and we have no idea how we really spent our time. You know, we're more awake and aware in certain activities. And so there's a bit of a click at some point where we get it, we understand it, and we're really willing to be present and to practice. And then I think to bring mindfulness, to bring the practice into the very complex and complicated arena of relationship, There's another kind of a click when we understand its importance and when we do find ourselves a bit more able to be awake and aware when we're in the company of others. The reason why it's so difficult is that we tend to lose ourselves in our minds, and we tend, perhaps more than in any other area of life, to react out of habit. Yeah. For our conditioned habits to really be very much holding us, and to really bring mindfulness into relationship, it takes a very kind of diligent approach. So this is what I'd like to talk about tonight, is how some ways to look at applying the practice to this arena of relationship to others. And I'm not narrowly defining it. You know, I'm not thinking just intimate relationship or relationship with your partner or your spouse or your husband or your wife, but really whomever you come in contact with. You know, right now we're in relationship. We're with each other. We're in relationship. When we leave here and we're perhaps walking or driving home, we're in relationship. You know, we're in relationship to anybody that we pass on the street, you know, whether we know that person or not. So really what I want to talk about is relationship in general. Practicing being mindful and aware in the midst of our everyday life. And also, so many of you here, I know, have had the experience of being on retreat, and we think being on retreat perhaps is all about being alone, and yet we're on retreat with others. And so bringing this practice into the silence of a retreat, there is so much we can learn too. In the silence of a retreat, and in the silence of simply sitting and doing nothing, we can be aware of our reactions without having to act them out. And so certain patterns and habits reveal themselves to us, you know, in the silence of the environment. And it's often true that by the end of a week of silence, where nobody's been talking to anybody, and the eye contact is not being encouraged, so it's not as if you're even making eye contact with anybody else. Friends are made and then lost by the end of the week. You know? People that you didn't like, enemies, by the end of the week you love them. You know? Things really begin to shift and change. And we tend to sort everybody out by the end of a week if we don't know who we've come in with. You know, if everybody is a bit of a stranger to us. By the end of the week, we see that there are those that we are afraid of. There are those that we are inspired by. There are those that we are extremely uninspired by. There are those that we feel judged by. There are those that we judge. There are those that we want to know better. There are those that we want to know less. There are those that we are indifferent to or absolutely uninterested in. There are those we find ourselves deeply interested in. There are those we find ourselves jealous of or depressed by or attracted to or annoyed by. You know, we begin to really see our reactions to a great variety of people. And we find ourselves also aware of those we are identified with. I had one roommate during a three-month retreat many years ago. I happened to have an extremely eccentric pair of socks with me. And this roommate happened to bring the same pair of eccentric socks with her. So we immediately, of course, you know, because what are you looking at? You're looking at down and at people's socks. We immediately felt this great bond with one another through our socks, through our apparel. This same person, many of you who have been on retreat know that someone goes around and rings the bell at the time when everyone's supposed to go back into the hall and sit again. So my roommate happened to be a bell ringer, and she had her job of going around the building ringing the bell. But what she would do when she passed my room, her room, is she would open the door and come in and ring it personally for me. Yeah. So with another kind of friendship in the silence that can occur. A lot is going on, even without eye contact. A lot can be going on in the silence. And of course, when there is eye contact, even more goes on. I remember being at a yoga retreat a long time ago, in my early 20s. I was at a yoga retreat that was maybe 5 or 7 days long. And it was completely in silence, and it was my first silent retreat. But nobody said anything about eye contact, and so there was a lot of eye contact going on. And it was so amazing to watch what was occurring. You know, there was courtship. There was marriage. Yeah. There were affairs. Two people would be looking at one another intensely for hours, and then you'd see two other people looking at one another intensely for hours, and the third person looking at those two people, looking at the two people looking intensely at one another for hours. And then, of course, there were divorces. And this was all, you know, in a celibate environment, you know? I mean, no touching, just the eye contact. But so much happening, so much going on in the midst of this. Even when we're not with others or when we're not talking to others, we can be aware of the inner dialogue that goes on. You know? I mean, it's such a funny thing to be realizing that nobody's actually there. Nobody's actually in front of us, and particularly the person that we're having a dialogue with is not in front of us. And yet, we create these enormously elaborate inner dialogues of explaining something to someone, of explaining ourselves, of describing. Sometimes we find ourselves doing something and we're describing what we're doing to another person. We find ourselves arguing, certainly, you know, having arguments with people who aren't there to be argued with. It's kind of convenient because we, get to speak the whole time. And the other person says that one terrible thing that they've said to us over and over and over and over again, you know. We also find ourselves defending ourselves or demanding something or confiding. You know, confiding something in somebody who isn't there. So this is all in the realm of relationship. You know, maybe it's imaginary, but it's still relationship. So the practice, of course, is not simply being awake and aware in the midst of whatever it is that we're doing in terms of activity. It's being awake and aware and quite caring in terms of trying to bring our practice into whomever we come into contact with. We practice being mindful of this body-mind experience while we're with others, not just while sitting, being by ourselves, not just while, you know, taking a walk somewhere or doing something on our own, but we see if we can actually practice being present while we're in the complexity of being with another person. And this allows us to explore beyond how things appear to be. All of us are conditioned, and because of this, we see someone, and it reminds us of something, and we slip into our conditioning, and then we react from that place. Or somebody says something to us, and we fall into the conditioning, and then we react from that place of reactivity. And the practice allows us to look more deeply, to stay present and aware and to become more mindful of our perceptions, to not assume that things are a certain way or someone is a certain way because of the immediacy of our reactivity. You know, we can begin to see sometimes that it's a perception. This is a perception. You know? And then it allows us to let go of the ways that we come to conclusions or that we assume and presume things to be a certain way and then find ourselves somewhat set in our ways or close-minded. Or putting others in boxes. You know? You were like this. Obviously so. Yeah, you are like that. Anybody would think so. Yeah? This kind of confinement that we tend to do. You know, and with the practice, with being mindful of the boxes, they are immediately released from our confining anyone in a certain way. You know, because we can rest a little easier and notice the box and in noticing the box, noticing you are like this, you are like that, based on our opinions and not always really knowing what's so, there's a bit of an ease and a relaxation and certainly a little bit of loving kindness that can take place. When we lose ourselves in reactivity and in conditioning, no wisdom is possible. And no compassion is possible either because we're objectifying ourselves and we're objectifying others. You know, so no real compassion or loving kindness is possible at that point. With the practice of mindfulness, bringing wakefulness and awareness into this dimension, we are actually practicing staying still, instead of moving into assuming and presuming and viewpoints and opinions. Mindfulness helps us to stay very quiet, to stop, to stay still, and to look within for what we are trying so desperately to find from the other person, in the other person. It allows us to settle into ourselves more and to look inside, to look within, instead of trying to find it and seek it in another. So it brings about a great deal of inner dignity and a sensitivity, you know, a certain degree of sensitivity. And it really is a way for us to learn how to love ourselves and others more deeply. And it is not easy to do. In working with a longtime practitioner a few years ago, this yogini had been practicing for many years, many, many years, and very diligent and very alive in the practice and really, really doing very, very well. While on retreat and while washing the dishes and while at work and this and that, but she, after a number of years, perhaps 15 years at the practice, she met someone that she really, really wanted to be with, that she fell in love with. And after kind of, you know, an initial phase of everything's thrilling and wonderful and happy, they began to have some difficulty together. And she began to have some difficulty with him, particularly when they would get upset with one another. And so she wanted some pointers, some ways to know how to practice with this situation, which is a really valid question. And so what I suggested is that she simply, whenever she was with him, whenever they were talking, or whenever she was listening to him, whenever she was speaking to him, whenever she was in contact with him, to simply be aware of her feet touching the floor. You know, just to keep her awareness focused on her feet touching the floor. Now, she was an older practitioner, older yogi, and her first reaction to this was, you know, can't you give me something that's better than this? You know, I've been practicing for a really long time and, you know, have been quite diligent. And you're telling me just to be aware of my feet touching the floor. I want something befitting my, you know, she was kidding, but something befitting my status as an older yogi. So I said, well, just try to trust me on this and see how it goes. Just do it for a week and let me know in a week how it goes. So she did. She tried to do it, and she came back after a week, and she said she was hardly able to be aware of her feet at all, you know, during the whole entire week, especially when she was getting upset. And so she began to see that actually this could be a very, very good practice for her, because she was thinking it would be so easy to do. She wanted something more advanced. And so she began to see that, you know, maybe I could try this more and at least be able to attain, you know, a couple of moments of being aware of my feet touching the floor, and then see where it goes from that. And so she started really practicing, really giving it a very good try. And she's very persevering. This person is just a very strong, persevering type. And so for really quite a while, it was very, very difficult for her to remember at all to be aware of her feet touching the floor. She'd come back every week and report, you know, a few moments this week and this and that. But then as she took it on over time and in a diligent and serious way, it began to catch her interest. You know, she stopped doing it because somebody had suggested that she do it. You know, she started doing it with a different perspective, and it began to bear fruit. Whenever this upsetness began to happen, whenever they got into a difficulty, and her immediate reaction would be to fall into feeling very hurt and then defensive and then wanting to attack, and then that escalating into something, and then, of course, pulling him into something, and you know, life carries on, she began to apply this practice of simply being aware of her feet touching the floor. She began to respect it and practice it. And everything began to change. I mean, it was so interesting to see this over a number of months and years, because the relationship itself began to stabilize itself and turned into an extremely rich and harmonious and long-lasting relationship. I mean, she ended up marrying him, which is, you know, neither here nor there, but she did. And she was also, when she went down the aisle in the church, she was attempting to be mindful of her feet touching the floor. I married them, so I was very happy that this was the outcome. Not the marriage, this was nice, but the being mindful of meditation teacher, being mindful of the feet touching the floor as she was going down the aisle. And so continuing to work with this, I mean, this was a number of years ago now, and the relationship itself has become so much more harmonious. And of course she worked with it in a number of different ways too. But what began it all was a way to steady and stabilize herself. Instead of being lost in thoughts and being caught by the emotions and being completely overwhelmed by conditioning and reactivity, it gave her a place to rest. You know, simply that. No big deal. Nothing magic, of course. But it gave her a place to rest. And then out of that stability and that resting point, she could begin to see things differently. She could begin to notice her mind. She could begin to notice the conditioning and the reactivity. And she began to be able to stay still through it, you know, observing it instead of being caught up in it, and then being able to make different choices than she had been able to make. Now, so instead of everything escalating, she was able to understand herself and this person more deeply, you know? and with a greater degree of love. So practicing in this way helps us to stay in ourselves when we're in contact with others. In sitting with our emotions as we sit, being aware of mental states and emotions, we have more of a chance of being more mindful of emotions as they arise in relationship. You know? So if we can be very clear about the emotions and reactions that are arising as we simply sit when we're out of contact, you know, when we're in contact, we have more of a chance of connecting, of being awake and aware. In the midst of relationship, we can see our inner obstructions more clearly. And then everybody becomes a mirror for us, not as an idea or a cliche, but in actuality. You know, every being that we come in contact with becomes a bit of a mirror. And this is what opens our practice up and out. And it's really a way to see what is happening in our practice. You know, I'm thinking of a story, an old story about this man who lived on the top of a mountain and was having a great time practicing on top of the mountain and began to feel enormously peaceful and happy and at ease and, you know, just thought things were going great. Thought things were going so great that he thought he should come down the mountain and start to teach others. And so he began to make his way down the mountain. And, you know, he was just walking mindfully, each step down the mountain, walking carefully. And as he got about halfway down, there was an older woman who was making her way up the mountain, who had a burden on her back. And as they passed, as this woman passed this man coming down the mountain, she kind of bumped him a little bit. And he got extremely upset, you know, by being bumped by another person. So, you know, where was the peace? Where was the ease? What happened if it so easily goes away? If it so easily is disrupted, then is it stable? Is it deep? You know, and this is a way that we can help one another as well. In practicing in the midst of relationship, we can learn how to be more responsive and less reactive. When we are present, and of course our practice is teaching us to be present, when we are present, intimacy is possible instead of disconnection. And when we are present, there is a sense of inner empowerment. We are not as subject to the emotions of others. We are not so much at the mercy of others because we are able to be responsive to the reactions that are occurring within us. So because of this, there is a newfound sense of empowerment. In other words, we can be aware and mindful instead of getting lost or overwhelmed or crushed by the way others are feeling and expressing that feeling. I mean, I guess one example that comes to mind for me is when a good friend is acting funny around you and seems upset and you don't know why that friend is upset. And maybe one asks, and maybe there's an answer that makes sense, and maybe there isn't an answer that makes sense. And yet one feels anxiety. You know, something was good and now it's not so good. And what happened? Did I do something wrong? You know, and one feels anxious, you know. And then to bring the practice in means to be aware, to sit, whether we're sitting, standing, you know, walking or lying down, to sit with the anxiety, to allow ourselves to meet that anxiety with wisdom and with compassion. You know, the compassion meaning recognizing that because pain is occurring, the natural response needs to be compassion and not judgment. You know, so bringing that compassion to the anxiety that is occurring and holding it as gently as we can without judging it. And the wisdom is to notice that it is just what it is. It's happening in the here and now. It's impermanent. It's changing. It's not who you are. It's not self. You know, it's an energy that comes out of our conditioning that is not a definition of who you are. And so if we can sit with something like this, be with something like this, we can begin to be less caught by our reactions to the reactions or emotions of others. When we're not present, when we forget to be present and mindful, what happens is that instinct takes over, conditioning takes over, instinct rules. And what we have experienced in the past, in terms of life, in terms of relationship, in terms of experiences, imposes itself on the present. And we're not aware of this. So there's a whole layer of something unconscious that is occurring, and we're not aware of it, so it's ruling us. You know, instinct really takes over. And we find ourselves lost in habits, whatever our habits in relationship have always been. We find ourselves lost in those habits. We find ourselves preoccupied, and we find ourselves losing our balance. Whereas when we can remember to be mindful and awake, we regain our sense of balance. And then wisdom can, at that point, begin to operate once again. When we are present, when we are able to be present or remember to be present, we can begin to see our agendas and our expectations. We can begin to see our attachments more clearly. We can begin to see the habitual ways that we speak, you know, the mechanical ways that we speak. This person says this, so we say that. You know, another person says that, and so we say this. And it's quite habitual and mechanical. We can begin to see our habitual actions and even our habitual thoughts, the way that we mechanically or habitually think when a person is a certain way. And it's all very different for all of us, and so one has to take this on and investigate and explore one's own conditioning, you know, in set of circumstances. We can notice a number of different agendas when we're willing to be aware and mindful of our agendas. You know, one very common agenda is wanting to be entertained by the other person, you know. I mean, we may be kind of on the boring side or think we're boring, but we think that the other person should always be charming and be entertaining us. I wanted to read you something by Nasruddin. Mulla Nasruddin was sitting in a tea shop when a friend came excitedly to speak with him. "I'm about to get married, Mulla," his friend stated, "and I'm very excited. Mulla, have you ever thought of marriage yourself?" Nasruddin replied, "I did think of getting married. In my youth, in fact, I very much wanted to do so. I waited to find for myself the perfect wife. I traveled looking for her, first to Damascus. There I met a beautiful woman who was gracious, kind, and deeply spiritual, but she had no worldly knowledge. I traveled further and went to Isfahan. There I met a woman who was both spiritual and worldly, beautiful in many ways, but we did not communicate well. Finally, I went to Cairo, and there, after much searching, I found her. She was spiritually deep, graceful, and beautiful in every respect, at home in the world and at home in the realms beyond it. I felt I had found the perfect wife." His friend questioned further, "Then why did you not marry her, Mulla?" "Alas," said Nasruddin as he shook his head, she was, unfortunately, waiting for the perfect husband. Another agenda that is very common is the agenda of wanting to be better than the person that we're with. You know, competition, the conditioning of competition kicks in. And so we're trying to outdo the other person. And you know, I mean, we're pretty much trained to not let it show. Huh? But inwardly, that is the pressure. That is what is happening. And sometimes it's very surprising when this arises. You know, it's with people that we're kind of surprised it's arising with. And then the practice is to kind of get over that surprise as quickly as possible and see if we can pay attention, attend, be aware. We might also have the agenda of wanting to be liked or wanting to be praised or wanting to be approved of. We might have the agenda of wanting to be made complete by that other person, wanting to be fulfilled by that other person. Now, we may very well have very reasonable agendas as well. You know, we might have the agenda that we should be treated with respect. And this is true. All beings in this world should be treated with respect. We might have the agenda that we should be treated with honesty. You know, it seems reasonable enough. Honesty, with kindness, with sensitivity. And it is true that all beings should be treated with honesty and with kindness and with sensitivity. The Buddha said, be in the company of the wise as much as you can. You know, that this is a wholesome and healthy thing. However, even though these agendas should be reasonable, are reasonable, and should be so, whether the agendas that we have are reasonable or whether they're unreasonable, the attachment to agendas equals suffering. You know, it doesn't matter in a certain way because attachment is suffering. And to be attached to an agenda, whether reasonable or not, gets in the way of finding happiness within. People then become a means to an end for us, instead of being here simply to be loved. We find ourselves manipulating and controlling. And we find ourselves dividing up beings into either problems or saviors. You know, you're a problem, you're a savior. You're a savior, you're a potential problem or a potential savior. You know, and then that whole realm of beings in between that we ignore those who aren't, who we don't see as potential saviors, or we don't have to kind of defend ourselves against potential problems. You know, so this whole area of beings that we don't even notice, perhaps. When our agendas aren't met, of course, our reaction, because of attachment, is disappointment and sometimes anger. Sometimes we want to withdraw, or we find ourselves discouraged or resigned and giving up in relationship. But the fact is that people don't cooperate. You know, they don't cooperate with our agendas. You know, it's not that we maybe can't get, you know, one or two people to cooperate more. Because this is true. We can. You know, we can do that kind of thing. And that's wholesome and healthy work in our intimate relationships. But there is no way that all beings are going to cooperate with our agendas, even if they are the most reasonable agendas in the world. So how do we work with this? You know, how do we work with this? This is where our practice really needs to come in. If our own thoughts and emotions are as out of control as they are, you know, and we can sit for even a very short amount of time and realize we can't think what we want to think, you know, we can't feel what we want to feel, that much more is the behavior of others out of our control. This is just another short thing about Nasruddin. Nasruddin was now an old man looking back on his life. He sat with his friends in the tea shop telling a story. When I was young, I was fiery. I wanted to awaken everyone. I prayed to Allah to give me the strength to change the world. In midlife, I awoke one day and realized my life was half over and I had changed no one. So I prayed to Allah to give me the strength to change those around me who so much needed it. Alas, now I am old and my prayer is simpler. Allah, I ask, please give me the strength to at least change myself. So this is what we are doing when we are practicing. We are taking responsibility for ourselves. There are a couple of ways to make peace with the fact that people don't cooperate. One of these ways is being mindful of our reactions. Because being mindful of our reactions as impeccably as we possibly can be, you know, not letting some go by and being mindful of others, but doing our best to sustain our attentiveness and being as mindful as we can in as consistent of a way as possible. This is the way of protecting our hearts. Then, whatever way others are, our hearts are stable, our hearts are strong, our hearts are actually protected. The other way is to discern the difference between attachment and connection. We do need to let go of attachment because it never works. It's impractical, you know? And it does equal suffering. But connection is mindfulness. So the more connectedness, the better. Yeah? So we want to learn how to connect with ourselves, to connect with others, without the attachment to agendas and expectations. And this can be a little bit of a, you can't assume what it is. My husband and I were walking down the street in Cambridge one day, and we were holding hands. And a yogi from the center came by, and from the center in Cambridge that we both teach in came by. And it was a very kind of quick dialogue that we had. We were walking down the street holding hands, and this yogi came by and said, pointed to our hands and said, attachment. And I don't know why, but I was just really on the ball. So immediately I said, connection. You know? And that was our dialogue, you know, that we discussed later. But to look at the difference between attachment and connection, I think, is very, very helpful. Attachment is the needing of things to be a certain way in order to be happy. Whereas connection is a fullness of heart. With connection, there's a reverence for life. There's a sacredness in life. There's a sense of respect and appreciation and of gratitude and of love. In letting go of wanting or having to have others fulfill our expectations, we allow for an interest. We allow ourselves to enjoy the contact instead of having rigorous ideas about how the other person should be. There's a relaxation. And so more often than not, even when somebody is being a total pain, there is a way in which there is an enjoyment of contact that can take place. In letting go of our agendas, you know, the attachment to our agendas, we open up to an immediacy of life. And this is what connection is contact with this immediacy of life, which is fresh and which is open and which is new. Instead of being lost in wanting to get something from the other person, which leaves us being quite insensitive, because maybe the other person doesn't want to give us that, or maybe the other person just can't give us that, whatever we want. So there's an insensitivity that enters in when we're attached, you know, because we have a very clear idea about what we have to have. in letting go of this, connectedness allows us to enter into a sensitivity, a quietness, and kind of a refined sensitivity. Instead of being addicted to pleasure and attached to pleasure, connectedness is being open to the fact of impermanence, you know, aware of both pleasure and pain. With attachment, the fact is that wisdom disappears. We don't have access to wisdom when there is attachment because connection is lost. And it's only out of contact, it's only out of connection that we can see anything clearly or differently than our conditioning tells us to. Attachment is a sense of dependency, of waiting to be saved by another person. And connectedness is a sense of inner empowerment, of living inside ourselves, you know, embodying our bodies, you know, really living from the inside out. And in this way, we can come to our relationship with others not as half beings needing to be completed by another half being. Yeah? We can come instead of out of a sense of deprivation. If we practice in this way and learn in this way and are open to learning in this way, we can come to our relationships as a full human being. Yeah? And this is a very, very different way to live. Instead of dwelling in self-doubt and in uncertainty, which is where we are when there is attachment, connection allows for an inner sense of confidence. And instead of the effort to be good, you know, the endless efforts we make of trying to be good, which often have to do with image and presentation, we can have a greater degree of confidence and trust in our inner goodness emerging. So we can have a greater degree of trust in our own Buddha natures. Many, many years ago, I met a Zen nun named Ayama Roshi. She came to Harvard to give a talk, and a few of us went over before the talk and had a really, really lovely chat with her. And I was about to go off for a three-month retreat, not the one with the person with the socks, but a later one, a later three-month retreat. And so I told her this, and I asked her for any advice that she had for me, or, you know, any. I was going off on my own for 3 months without any teacher. And I asked if she had any suggestions for me, or, you know, words of wisdom or advice. And she looked at me and she said, you know, just come back more like yourself. You know? And she didn't know me, so it's not like she was saying, you know, you're so wonderful that you should, you know, become more like you. It wasn't like that at all, I can guarantee that. It was impersonal, you know. It was what she would say to anybody. It's what I would say to you, you know, having heard it from her, is, you know, practice to become more like yourself, meaning letting go of the extra, letting go of the veneer, letting go of the presentation and image and ideas about how we have to be, you know, to really be able to touch this inner goodness that is there within each one of us. Patience with the patterns of others really comes about through having a greater degree of patience with our own patterns, you know, with our own reactions and conditioning and difficulties. And to be patient with our own patterns, you know, the kind of repetitive patterns that just seem to never go away, you know, we need to be aware of our impatience. Because being aware of our impatience, that it should already be gone already, is what allows us to really know patients. The direction of this practice is towards an open-heartedness. Instead of being self-centered, centered in ourselves, or instead of being other-centered. Because sometimes we think the practice goes in the direction of letting go of self-centeredness and instead being other-centered. But actually, it's neither one. It's not being self-centered, it's not being other-centered. It's being open-hearted and available to life. In practicing in this way, there is a gradual reharmonization of the heart. And then we really can understand something that Rumi said. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. Okay, so that's it.